Welcome everyone to the Dhamma Sanchas. In these 2 weeks in March, we had the pleasure of having George Sellick living with us as a Quaker in residence. He is well known to most of you as former Executive Secretary of Cambridge Friends Meeting, and probably a very good friend to most of you. George has left his nice island home to be in our urban wastes, and for those who don't know, he was also involved with the American Friends Service Committee from 1948 to 1950. A group he's been very closely associated with. He is now currently working on a book on Boston Quakers. His topic for this evening is Lessons from Boston Quaker History.
When I was invited to come, I was told you weren't interested in Quaker history. You just want to know what I had learned about Quaker history. So that's my topic tonight, lessons that I have learned from Boston Quaker history. I'm going to try to speak briefly tonight. I want to say what I have to say and then let you ask some questions. Because I want to be brief, I think I can be briefer if I stand up. If I sit, I may ramble. Well, it was very interesting when I was asked to talk about lessons that I have learned from Boston Quaker history. Because then I began to think what I had learned. And I felt I could pick out 4 or 5 things that seemed to me important. Observations that I had made as I had gone along for the past 9 years, studying Quaker history from 1656 clear up through the present. The first thing I'm going to mention is the importance of the meeting house during that period. It's been 320 years since Quakers first came to Boston, and there has been a Quaker meeting house here for friends to use all except 82 years of that 320. The first 39 years, it was illegal to have a meeting house here. The Puritans said their church was the only one, and no one was allowed to exist here who wanted to have another church. The Baptists were driven out. Roger Williams was driven out. Ann Hutchinson was driven out. And the Quakers were driven out, too, but the Quakers didn't stay driven out. They came back. They couldn't legally have a meeting for worship for the first 5 years. In 1661, they broke down the Pilgrim resistance, had their first public meeting for worship. George Fox tells about in his journal. But it wasn't until 1695, after the King of England had declared freedom in America, that they were able to build their first meeting house in 1695. There was a meeting house then from 1695 right straight on through until 1828, and that was sold. Then there was 3 years gap before the Yearly Meeting built another one in 1831, and that was sold in 1865. And then there was a gap from 1865 to 1894 when a new meeting was getting started. In 1870, they met for 2 years in the Boston YMCA, then for 20 years in Wesleyan Hall. Then they built a new meeting house again in 1894, and that was sold in 1926 because the community had changed and the friends had moved off to other parts of Boston. And so they met for 11 years in Andover Hall at Harvard. But they had no idea, no intention of making that a permanent place. When they began to meet together at the beginning of that 11-year period, they said, neither one of us will plan to build a meeting house without the other one, and we'll have a joint meeting house if we build one. And so they kept their eyes open for a possible site. And it was in 1936 that William Duguid discovered this property on Longfellow Park, and the meeting agreed, that's just what we want, so we've had a meeting house ever since. So the meeting house for the Friends here has always been a very important thing. The Friends meeting in Boston went out of existence in 1808. There were no Friends meeting again in Boston until 1870. But in spite of that, the Yearly Meeting built a new meeting house in 1831, which was used entirely for public meetings. They had a special concern that in the city of the Quaker martyrs, there should be a Quaker presence. And many visiting friends spoke, among them Joseph John Gurney, A lot of others I could mention. The next three lessons I have learned are very closely related. I think you'll see what I mean when I have finished with these three. The first is the importance of the right use of the friend's business meeting, the friend's business procedure. Twice in Boston history, the Quaker business procedure broke down. In 1738, there were several members of the meeting who were all concerned about a point of theology. They wrote a paper and published it as From Friends, saying that we believe that everyone will be saved regardless of whether they go off the stage of this earth in sin or not. And the meeting said, "Why, we don't put out theological statements like that. We think that a public announcement should be prepared and distributed showing what friend the Quaker stand really is." And so a committee of seven friends was appointed to draw up a proper statement. Unfortunately, they did not bring the statement to the monthly meeting for approval before they published it. They published it right out because they'd been appointed to do so. And the man who was the leader of those who had made the first unapproved statement thought that they had overstepped their mark by publishing their official statement unapproved by the monthly meeting. He brought the matter before the monthly meeting, tried to have the committee censured. The monthly meeting agreed with the committee, stood by its committee. This friend appealed to the quarterly meeting. It stood by the committee. And then he appealed again to the yearly meeting, and the yearly meeting stood by the committee's action. But this process lasted for several years, and since there were several friends involved, a number of friends involved in this, it meant that there was a festering of ill feeling in the meeting there for several years, from 1738 on up through 1740-41. And visiting friends who came around 1733-34 commented that there had been a very trying time in Boston, but it was better now than it had been. And then there was a second time in 1896. There was a friend by the name of Benjamin Trueblood who had come to Boston, who was very much excited about the new Quakerism, the progressive Quakerism, which had just been developed out in the Middle West, in Iowa and some other places. He thought that was the Quakerism of the future. And he came to Boston as the head of the American Peace Society. And since he was a Quaker minister, he sat at the head of the meeting and he preached every Sunday. He considered himself a sort of a pastor, an exponent of this new type of progressive Quakerism. After a while, the meeting didn't go quite as well as he had hoped it would under his leadership. And he decided that the meeting, I shouldn't say he decided, in talking with the ministry and council, ministry and oversight, they together decided that there should be someone to take fuller charge of the pastoral work of the meeting. They made that decision without consulting the monthly meeting. And they had a man come who had been the superintendent of Iowa Yearly Meeting and who had been one of the foremost proponents of this new progressive Quakerism in Iowa. And I'm sure Benjamin Trueblood thought that this was a real find for Boston to have this outstanding Quaker leader of the new progressive Quakerism. And he took up his duties as pastor. He didn't join the meeting. He was here as a friend visiting from Iowa, working with the friends in Boston. But after a while, the friends in Boston began to be disaffected. They were objecting. They couldn't lay their fingers just on what had happened. They didn't know what the trouble was. So they sent a message to the quarterly meeting, and the quarterly meeting appointed a special committee to come down here and to see what the situation was and to find out what could be done. And let me read you the report of that quarterly meeting committee. In the committee's judgment, they wrote, there were three main problems at issue. One, the lack of harmony that exists in relation to Ice and Pete Wooten's connection with the meeting. After you carefully consider the matter, you may find it desirable to effect a change. It is, in our judgment, absolutely essential for the greatest usefulness of the Christian worker who labors among you that you should be practically united upon the person called to such service. Two, there were differences as to method of worship. The method of worship, they wrote, should be in accord with that long-established doctrine of things wherein every member is himself a priest unto God. We believe all our meetings for religious worship should be so conducted that each individual member should have full freedom to exercise his gift, and that no program or arrangement of service shall be allowed in a friend's meeting which will interfere with such exercises of gifts. And thirdly, they felt there had been the making of decisions in business meetings without waiting for unity. If in the consideration of subjects in meetings for discipline, a conclusion is not unanimous, and those who are opposed cannot condescend to the judgment of the larger number without feeling grieved, then we believe the only safe course to pursue is to pass from the subject until friends can reach a harmonious conclusion. Nothing in the spirit of majorities has a place in a friend's meeting. Finally, the committee urged those friends who had dropped out of meeting affairs to take up their places again. Inasmuch as harm is often occasioned by the non-attendance of meetings on the part of prominent members, we advise that you give careful attention to this matter and that whenever practicable, you regularly attend all the meetings in a spirit of cheerful helpfulness on all lines where the members can agree. Those who had felt that this was the right step to take had not listened to the quiet voices of protest, which were being one of the lessons I've learned is the importance of listening to the unspoken objections, I will say, to encourage everyone to take part. The Quaker method does not work fast. It's not for those who are impatient. We must be willing to wait for unity, not uniformity of opinion, but unity of spirit. If we cannot be in full agreement, we can at least give our assent. We need from time to time to review the bases of our Quaker business meetings. One of the happy discoveries of the early Quakers was that individuals, each endeavoring to follow the light within, would be led to a unity. That the group could be led as well as the individual. We are asked to seek even a higher leading of the group. The failure of the method is usually due to pushing our own ideas rather than listening to the voice within. It's the task of the clerk to sense that unity when it appears and to put it into a minute. Pressure groups with their minds made up and not open to divine guidance that would draw friends into a greater unity do not belong in a friend's meeting for business. Every voice must be heard. Differences of opinion must not be suppressed for the sake of unity. The Quaker method works to reconcile real differences. It's all a matter of willingness to abide by the leading of the group. Now, related to this somewhat is the whole question of ranters. We think of ranterism as being something that it belongs to ancient history. When the Quakers first came to Boston, they were worried by the ranters. Rather, the ranters were always worrying them. And the Quakers, the Puritans, were always confusing the Quakers with the ranters who had been here before. But ranterism is not a matter of ancient history. There are ranters today, but don't call them by that name. And so one of the things I've learned is how to spot ranters when you see them. In other words, when the Quakers first came, they were distinguished from the ranters by being conscious of themselves as a group. The ranters were individualists gone mad. They believed in following their own impulses. What feels good is good. I don't have any record of their saying that, but that was the spirit in which they lived. What feels good is good. Every impulse must be trusted. And that sort of attitude leads to anarchy. There's nothing that can be built upon that. No group can be built upon that sort of attitude. But for the Quaker, there was something more than just the individual. There was the consciousness of being a group. And that consciousness of being a group came about because they felt that when they were following the light within, they were following not something subjective, but something beyond them. That's what they meant when they spoke of the light of Christ within. It was something beyond their own individual light, something which they could all together reach out for. John Perrott was a Quaker in those early days who was drawn in the direction of this Ranterism philosophy. He objected to any forms in religion, even the form of meeting for worship once a week. You should meet only when the Spirit led you. There should be no form of prayer. Pray only when you felt like it. In other words, any sort of form or regulation or agreement among friends was to be done away with. Under his influence, there were meetings down in Virginia, or friends down in Virginia who didn't meet for worship once in a year. And there were followers of John Perrott in Boston. And we can trace the effects of their influence in Boston. When they tried to have meetings, there were some of the friends who wouldn't meet with them. They didn't believe in meeting. It was a form. One of the reasons that George Fox came to America in 1672 to establish monthly meetings was to counter the effects of John Perrott's philosophy of just following your impulses. No forms. George Fox set up monthly meetings here and there, everywhere that he could, in order that friends as a group could have something to say about what he called the disorderly walkers. So the monthly meeting, the organization of the monthly meetings, was something that was done to counter this extreme individualism, which was characteristic of the ranters and of the followers of John Perrott. And in a sense, one might say that the contributions of George Fox, the chief contribution of George Fox to the Society of Friends, was the setting up of the monthly meetings. For without that, the Society of Friends never would have developed, it would never have survived from those early days to the present. A minimum of discipline, a minimum of form, which would keep these individualists from flying off in all directions. And, shall we say, imposing or at least laying a minimum of discipline upon the group and making the group discipline possible. And associated with this, I've learned that Quakers found it important to encourage a sense of community. The ranters opposed it, but the Quakers wanted to encourage this sense of community in the monthly meeting and in their group worship, in their group experiences. I've already mentioned that George Fox recognized this and set up his monthly meetings to make that possible. Shortly after 1700, the New England Friends decided to appoint visitors or overseers. Their job was to call on all the members of the meeting and to inform them about the new rules that had been adopted in the system. And then for several years they forgot that. Again they appointed the visitors in 1780. And then after 1870, when the Friends meeting started up again in Boston as a result of the evangelical interest, one of the primary emphases of evangelicalism was the necessity of pastoral care of the members. And a few years later, they appointed pastors to take over that responsibility. I think that many Friends have felt that the pastoral responsibility should be left to the pastors, and if you got rid of the pastors, then you were free of responsibility for pastoral work. I think that's not true. I think the Friends before that had found that the pastoral responsibility of the meeting was the responsibility of the meeting as a whole, not of appointed persons. And so there have been attempts to restore to the meeting pastoral responsibility. And how can that be done best? Well, it seems to me there are two methods. One, through a deepening of our response to the light within. George Fox wrote that Friends should know one another in that which is eternal. That is, the deeper you go, the closer you become. And that's one of the best ways to increase the fellowship of the meeting. However, there was another way which was used, and that was the way of the visitors, of calling on the families, finding what their problems were, and talking them over with them. Concern and care for one another. So there are those three that are very closely related, in my mind, at least the lessons that I've learned from them. The business meeting, with the importance of group guidance. The ranters, who opposed group guidance. And then the sense of encouraging the sense of community. And the sense of community also is one of the bases of the Quaker business meeting. The last lesson that I want to mention, well, I put in the form of the question, are there cycles in Quakers? Do we get repeats of things over and over again so that if we can spot ourselves in the present cycle, can we forecast the future? Well, let's see. I don't know whether this holds water or not, but at least it seemed interesting to me. I'll try to outline some of the things I saw. Quakerism at all times includes two elements. First, an inward sensitivity to the light of Christ within, both in worship and as a guide to action. And secondly, Quakerism is a way of life. It's a life to be lived. Can we speak of a Quaker lifestyle? If you see a Quaker, can you say, oh, that's a Quaker? Quakers live that way. Can you? Are there Quaker attitudes that are distinctive of Quakers? I heard the other day of a young lady who happened to be married, that is, she'd been to college, now she was going back to do some graduate study after she'd had some children. She was going to Boston University and was very much impressed with a professor she had there. After a while, she went up to him and said, you know, I'm much impressed with your point of view. It seems to me to be very much like the Quakers. I'm a Quaker. I'm a Quaker, too. Well, how did it happen that one Quaker recognized another by their attitudes? Is that something real? Can we say there are real Quaker attitudes that are characteristic of Quakers today? The relative emphasis upon these two has varied from time to time. We might say the two emphases are mysticism versus conduct. Another way of putting it might be this. Is the Quaker lifestyle something derived from inner guidance, inwardly motivated, or Is it something enforced by outward rules and social pressure? And both have been tried. And they seem to have come alternately. For the first 15 years, when friends first came to Boston and were challenging the Puritans, they were quite mystical. They were quite enthusiastic about their dependence upon the light within. They felt led to go to Boston, even though they knew they would be hanged, that they felt they were doing the Lord's will. And they were quite enthusiastic. When Mary Dyer came to Boston and thought she was going to be hanged, she was really disappointed when she went home and found that she'd been thwarted. And she insisted on coming back in order to fulfill the Lord's will. George Fox came in 1672 with his organization, A Month of Meetings, and he left a volume of advices, which is still down in Providence. Advices on what friends should do about marriage. All sorts of rules of conduct. I couldn't commit what they are now. They're in my book. You must read that. He introduced the first standards of conduct. Just as advice is not really rules. But do you know that the mere organization of monthly meetings drove out of the society some of the first leaders? They were so enthusiastic about this freedom of the spirit, which they could follow freely, that they did not want to be subject to a monthly meeting. There were a number of the younger sons of the aristocracy in England who were among the leaders, and many of them left the society at that time when monthly meetings were organized. From 1695 to about 1720, the friends in New England established their new discipline in 1790, and they adopted queries in 1702, and in that discipline they set up rules of conduct, all sorts of rules, about whether your children should, whether there should be schools for Quaker children, whether Quakers could bury in the usual burial grounds and have stone or palings over their graves, and the yearly meeting decided they shouldn't have either. About whether you should marry anyone who is not a Quaker and so on, all sorts of rules. That was between 1695 and 1720. But then following 1720, the Quakers began to forget all these rules. They were rather worldly in their outlook. There was no membership list. Anyone who wanted to call himself a Quaker could consider himself so. And in 1729, the legislature even gave to Quakers the privilege of being free from the church tax. That quarter of a century was one where there was quite an economic depression, and there were a number of people who were glad to save that tax by joining the Quakers. And in that period, from 1720 up towards 1760, I would say, there were more Quakers in Boston than any other time in the old time. They had practically no standards of membership. They had good mystical meetings for worship, but a great fringe of people who didn't take seriously their Quaker obligations. There was no way to hold them to them. There was no membership list, nothing to hold them, except the desire to worship with friends. They grew, but then, about the time of the American Revolution, Quakers began to say, oh, we've got to make Quakerism stand for something. So then they adopted a new discipline and new rules. They were very strict about what these rules should be. There should be Quaker education for their children. They should free their slaves and even pay their slaves for back labor. They should use the Quaker language, the endow. There should be no fellowship with other people of other churches. There should be simplicity in clothing and lifestyle. He even appointed committees to go around and inspect your homes to see whether they were simple or not. No marrying out, no marrying people who were not friends. And you know what happened? When those rules were adopted, there were two things that happened. There were a great many friends who overstepped those boundaries and who were put out of meeting. And the young people wouldn't accept the rules. And they left. From 1780 to about 1870, the chief occupation of the Quaker business meeting was disowning people who were members. And it's no wonder that during the early 1800s, Friends declined markedly. It was only when the evangelical movement started up in about 1860 to 1880, when new meetings were started here in New England and all over the country, with new enthusiasm, that Friends began to grow again. Even in the very earliest days of the rebirth of Quakerism in Boston, about the 1870s and 80s, there was one Friend who was disowned in the old fashion for having divorced her husband. But after that, very few Friends were divorced. I mean disowned, divorced from Quakers. And then came the evangelical movement in New England or in Boston. That should have been a time for growth, but they didn't grow as much as they might have, partly because they were thwarted by this disagreement over the pastor that I read you about a while ago, and partly because of sociological changes in the vicinity of their meeting house down in Roxburgh. The Friends had moved away. New Friends, when they came, didn't live in Roxburgh. They lived out in Belmont, Cambridge, Wellesley, Newton. And their attendance down in Roxbury dropped down to about 36 on Sundays. They had the first day school, but only two Quaker children in it. All the rest were Negro children from the community. And when the Negro church came along and said, "We'd like to buy your church," the Friends reluctantly said yes and moved to Cambridge. And then something else happened. Not since 1926, shall we say, there was a growing emphasis on mystical worship, the silent meeting that was accepted by all, even those who had had the program meeting down in Roxbury. This had a wide appeal, and the meetings have grown. But there has been, there has been relatively little emphasis on there being a Quaker standard of conduct. Can you tell a Quaker today by his behavior? Does this mean that we are to expect a reaction against the mystical emphasis and a growing demand for meeting more directly Christian standards of conduct? Is this the wave of the future? And will it turn many people away from Friends? Will stricter standards of Quaker conduct turn away our young people? I don't know. It's just an intriguing idea. That's what happened before. Will it happen again? And so there are these five lessons that I say I've learned. I've learned a lot more things too, but these are the ones I thought I'd tell you about. One, the importance of the meeting house in the whole history of the society in Boston. Secondly, the need to review the bases of our Quaker business meetings to avoid problems that arise from not using it rightly. And third, to be able to recognize the randerism today. Those who are not sensitive to the leadings of the group that insist upon their own individual leadings. Primer. Fourth, the importance of the meeting's responsibility for a sense of community in the meeting. We need pastoral care. The question is how to do it best. And then fifthly, while Friends religion includes both, there seems to be alternation in emphasis on mysticism and outward conduct. Is ours now a period of mystical inwardness? Are we due for a recurrence of emphasis on conduct when members will be disowned for non-compliance? Now, I don't know whether you have any questions or not, but you may. I'll be glad to have them.